This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton in studio today with Ashley Thornburg, and we're joined in Bismarck by Dave Glott. He's the Environmental Health Section Chief for the North Dakota Department of Health, because it's April 22nd. It's Earth Day. Time to check on the condition of our planet and our place. This idea is 43 years old today. A former senator from Wisconsin, a guy by the name of Gaylord Nelson, came up with this idea. And the first Earth Day was April 22nd, 1970. So on this 43rd Earth Day, welcome to Dave Glott, who joins us in Bismarck. Thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you, and happy Earth Day to you, too.
And what are the responsibilities of your section? Sort of lay it out for us here.
Well, we're a part of the North Dakota Department of Health, and we have responsibility for implementing the major environmental protection programs in the state of North Dakota. Primarily looking at things such as the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Safe Drinking Water Act, so many more acts that I can't remember them all, but it's just primarily implement them at the local level to protect public health and the environment.
What would you say are some of the biggest issues affecting those, the clean water, the air?
Well, yeah, it's no surprise that North Dakota is going through a big change here the last couple of years, especially with oil field development. And on the big scale, what we're seeing is it's changing in the fact that North Dakota is changing from a rural agricultural state to a rural industrial state. And that's providing us with some challenges we've never had to deal with in the past. We're seeing increasing population. We're seeing people that coming into the state that haven't lived here for a long time. And so they have a different outlook on how to address environmental protection issues. And finally, on a big scale, we're seeing more global issues and regional issues where in the past, if you just dealt with the issues that you had in Bismarck or Fargo, you were good. But now what you do in those cities have an impact downstream or downwind several states away and several countries away. And so those are the challenges we face.
Well, we certainly run into that when we have to interact with Canada, on, for example, on our water. And we hear about that with the air conditions in parts of the state in regard to particulate matter that may or may not meet the EPA standards. So how has this all affected your workload?
Increased it dramatically. The challenges are a lot greater than I've ever seen. I've been with the department about 30 years, and it seems like every day I come into the office, I'm learning something new or finding a new challenge. Some of the issues that we're dealing with on the regional basis is flooding, for an example, which is near and dear to Fargo's hearts. But when you look at flooding on the Red, you got flooding in Devil's Lake. We had flooding in the Minot area. And those have an environmental component, not only to the devastation that it can create, but you have increased waste issues. You have increased indoor air issues with mold. You have loss of land use, which is an environmental issue for a lot of people. And so those are major challenges for us. And what kind of complicates that is you're dealing with multi-jurisdictional issues, which you alluded to with Canada, for example. They can be helpful to us in many ways, and sometimes they might not be quite as helpful as we'd like them to be. And so those are some of the issues. Flooding has been right now is on our plate and what we're addressing on a full-time basis.
I saw specifically on your website under the Division of Water Quality, the two that you mentioned almost right away here, Devil's Lake and Missouri River issues, those are both kind of under this heading of special projects. Why those two in particular?
Well, Devil's Lake it's interesting. We just had a gentleman that retired from our office after 35 years of working with us, and he came. His first job was to work with the Devil's Lake issues when he first started with the department. And when he left 35 years later, he was still dealing with Devil's Lake issues. That's either too dry or too wet, and right now we're too wet. What's happening there is that it does have a natural outlet. The lake levels are coming up. There's lots of farmland that's going underwater. The city of Devil's Lake has been protected, but not after an excessive amount, not excessive, but a lot of investment into diking systems. And so when we want to alleviate some of that flooding and drain water downstream, people are concerned about what will that do to them. And we've had concern expressed by Valley City, Fargo, and Manitoba. The challenge is trying to find that balance. How much water can we get out to alleviate flooding and still not impact people downstream? And we've been fairly successful at that so far. But this coming spring, we're looking at another 3-foot rise in the lake, in Devil's Lake, and that's going to be a challenge for us, especially when you have flooding downstream. You don't want to add to the flooding to the folks in Fargo, so you're going to have to wait to let water out of Devil's Lake until an opportune time to where we can get as much water out of there as we can.
You mentioned, of course, that the flooding that's imminent on the Red River and perhaps on the Cheyenne as well, and of course the Missouri is not immune to that. When you have a significant flood, like we're expecting, and all this water washes over land that it's not usually part of the channel, what happens to the water quality?
Well, and that's a good point. You know, anything that's on the land surface is probably going to end up in the red in one way, form, or another. Concern about nutrients running off farmland. Concern about a few years ago with the flood, we had agricultural storage facilities that had fertilizer and pesticides. Concern about that washing in to the river. So you will see changes in water quality. Fortunately, the river is pretty resilient, and it can assimilate a lot of that, but it also flushes downstream fairly quickly, not to the pleasure of our downstream neighbors. But there's not much we can do about that once it gets into the water itself. And so what you try to do is do preventative measures to take all that type of material, chemical compounds, out of harm's way if you can.
Are you ever able to, if you know a flood event is likely, and it seems like they are increasing in likelihood from year to year, are you ever able to talk to farmers and regulate the amount of pesticide? Does that ever change?
Specifically? It's a difficult one. Farmers are a very independent lot, and I will tell you that they are becoming more in tuned with what they do on their operation has a potential impact on the environment. Primarily, what we'd like to see is less use, which if they can find that balance to get good crop production with less inputs, that saves them money. It's interesting that one of the things we talk about are nutrient additions into the rivers and streams and lakes, and that is one of the other big issues that's hitting us on a national level and a regional level. Is what is North Dakota going to do to try to improve the quality of its rivers and lakes by reducing the amount of nitrogen and phosphorus that gets into our water bodies? What we're doing right now is trying to establish a strategy that what makes scientific sense for us, for North Dakota, what activity should we be looking at to reduce nutrient input into the water bodies to improve its water quality? And that's going to be a challenge for us because it's not only agriculture, it is industrial sources and municipal sources. And then there's a natural component as well that we all have to look at to see what we can do to try to improve the quality of our water in the state.
Do you see any issues with fracking going through, for example, groundwater supplies and casing it, I'm sure? Is there any reason we should be concerned about the quality of groundwater in western North Dakota?
You know, what we're seeing to date is the short answer to that is no. North Dakota's been in drilling through our uppermost drinking water aquifers for over 50 years. Mm-hmm. And so we haven't seen that problem. And I get asked this question. Matter of fact, I was asked it twice in church this last weekend. But I was listening to the sermon in case my pastor's listening there too.
Very good.
But the fracking part isn't as much of a concern to me as what it brings. It brings increased development. You have a lot more truck traffic. You have pipelines. And that's where we're seeing our biggest concern is the potential contamination at the surface from spills, accidental and illegal, and also just the increased population, the stress on the infrastructure, such as our water treatment and wastewater facilities, that has just exploded. And to be quite honest, we're playing catch-up in a lot of areas. Fortunately, we've had good cooperation from the local towns and cities and also from industry to help us address these issues.
You said accidental and illegal spills. Do you have a lot of illegal spills?
We get a lot more than we ever have in the past, and I wouldn't say a lot. You know, we're probably looking at a couple reports a month of the illegal spills. As far as the accidental spills, I probably get 5 reports a day of trucks turning over, valves breaking, you know, pipelines breaking, that type of thing. A lot of those have been fairly localized, and we've been able to address those with quick response by the companies and also oversight by the state.
Let's talk for a moment about waste management issues. There was a story in the Forum of Fargo-Moorhead today that reporting that Fargo has about 11 years left on its landfill. What ways are we looking at these days to better deal with our trash instead of just, you know, piling it up? Are there other technologies, other approaches that the state is looking at and sharing the information?
We're beginning to. You know, to North Dakota's benefit or detriment, depending how you want to look at it, we've been blessed with a lot of open space. And land is relatively cheap when you look at other technologies that try to deal with handling waste. And so it's just been easier for somebody to go out and buy a piece of land and turn that into a landfill. I think we're going to have to be in a different paradigm, and we're going to have to start shifting on how we start looking at how we deal with our waste issues. We need to do a better job of recycling to start with. Trying to get to the point where, I think it was San Francisco's looking at trying to get to the point where they don't really have to use a landfill. Everything's going to be recycled. That would be a great place to be. But North Dakota, we're kind of slow to react to that just due to our landmass. We have heard some discussion about incinerators. There's an upside to that where you generate electricity, you have less landfill space needs, but then you also have air emissions, which is a downside and a concern to some people. But we really haven't had any major proposals that relate to anything other than just landfill at this point in time.
But I know the Fargo landfill uses some reclaimed gas, actually, to operate the landfill, to power it. So.
Yeah, and that's a good thing. You know, we've typically haven't done that. I think that's the only one in the state. I think there are some potential opportunities in other larger cities in the state to do that as well, and we would encourage that if they see their way fit to invest in that.
You know, one thing that I would really like to talk about, because I think this is just something that's always going to be on the rise in this day and age, is electronic waste and everything from, you know, cell phones and iPods and everything that we have that we go through very quickly. I mean, generally speaking, people get a new cell phone every couple of years. And even to things like last time I went shopping for a new oven, they said it might only last 5 or 6 years given the LED panel that was in there. And that's something that we really didn't used to have to think about. Those kinds of things lasted, you know, for decades. Can you comment on just the state of electronic waste?
Well, yeah, we have in the past been kind of a, we're turning into more of a disposable society where you anticipate that you buy a new refrigerator or a television or a stove, and it's not going to be around 5 to 8 years from now. And that is good for the companies that manufacture them, but it also it creates that electronic disposal waste stream that we have to deal with. In North Dakota, again, it's been easier for us to just deal with those household wastes by depositing them in the landfill. I do think, you know, as a state, we need to start looking at how do we start recycling that material. And I do think that starts with the manufacturer. They need to be more involved in finding ways to have take-back type situations where they'll take back your stove after 5 years, take it back, recycle the parts that they can. And I think that would be the way to go. Not much different than what we do with our used batteries when you drop one off and pick up a new one.
Has your section championed any legislation during the current session? Do you see the need for any?
Well, this last session, we were looking more at wastewater disposal issues, particularly as it relates to individual homes. North Dakota does not have a comprehensive on-site sewage waste disposal program. And because of that, it's kind of a hodgepodge of activities. You know, some have very good regulations in some counties. Other counties have nothing at all. And we see that as a public health and an environmental hazard. And by having consistent rules and regulations, I think we'd be in a better position to protect public health and the environment. And that was the one thing that we looked at. What came of it was there's 2 bills, one dealing with septic tank pumpers, and in the oil patch we had problems with raw wastewater just being dumped wherever without any controls. That passed, and so we are having the opportunity to have better oversight on how wastewater is being handled from the man camps, from some of our larger communities, and from some of the trailer parks. What didn't pass was the comprehensive rules as it relates to construction of those facilities, and that's something that we'll have to work on next session.
Well, Dave, I noted that you started working with the Department of Health in 1983, so you're 30 years into this career. Does your office observe Earth Day?
It does, and we are participating with other state and federal and local agencies to develop an Earth Day here in Fargo. I mean Fargo, in Bismarck, and would encourage Fargo to do the same. But it tries to get information out to children, that are younger citizens. I find that I have four kids of my own, and they keep reminding me to recycle.
Okay.
And so maybe that's where it starts. And so we're having a get-together on April 25th at the Bismarck College that is open to the public from 3 to 7. And,
all right.
And we'll deal with Earth Day activities.
Earth Day, and of course it's Earth Week as well in lots of places too. So thank you for joining us today. Dave Glott, Environmental Health Section Chief for the North Dakota Department of Health. We're going to have a little Earth Day trivia in just a moment.
Tonight's television lineup on Prairie Public starts with the Antiques Roadshow from Rapid City. Then at 8 Central, the Market Warriors are on the scene at the Liberty Antiques Festival in North Carolina. And at 9 on Independent Lens, the island president looks at the first year in office of Maldives President Mohamed Nasheed, who undertakes a campaign to raise awareness about the catastrophic consequences of global warming. Tune in tonight on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Doug Hamilton and Ashley Thornburg with you today to talk about Earth Day. It is April 22nd, and every year that comes around, we look at the planet and say, thank you. Ashley, did you come up with some interesting stuff? Guys, I came across some.
Well, I'll start out with maybe a couple of easier ones,
okay.
But then we'll see from there. What river caught on fire, famously in the 60s, prompting evaluation of water pollution control?
Well, it was a river in Cleveland, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because my father actually used to know the editor of the Cleveland Plain Dealer. They were at a college reunion, and my dad joked at him, at least he didn't live where the rivers burned. So it was whatever that big river is that goes through Cleveland to the lake, I think.
And, you know, I'm seeing this in print, so I want to make sure that I'm saying this correctly. Is it the Cuyahoga?
It's the Cuyahoga.
Cuyahoga.
It's the Cuyahoga, yeah.
All right.
Thank you. I got one for you then. How many pounds of trash did the United States create per person every day in 2010?
Oh.
I'll give you a choice.
Is it triple digits?
No.
It's okay.
1.23, 3.46, or 4.43 pounds per day per person.
Oh, I forgot the per day part. I'm going with 4.
You got it.
Okay.
Less than 5 pounds may not seem like much, but if you multiply it times 365, it's over 1,600 pounds of garbage per person over a year.
What book by Rachel Carson is considered one of the main reasons that launched the environmental movement?
Silent Spring.
Yes. And that was about?
Oh, you know what? I don't remember. I think it had to do with birds not making any noise.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that was DDT
and,
then.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep, DDT.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Here's one that really intrigued me. What percentage of hybrid car owners replace it with another hybrid when it's time to get a new car?
Oh, I'm guessing 100%.
Well, your options would be 79%, 45.2%, or 35%.
Well, I'll go 79 then.
You would be wrong because only 35% of people who buy a hybrid once buy one again.
Does it say what are the main reasons for it?
I wish it did. It says it just makes a comment. With all the praise they receive, isn't it surprising so few drivers buy a second one?
Hmm. I am intrigued by that.
Maybe they haven't had time yet, though. They haven't been out that long.
Let's see here. In reference to climate change, 350 is considered a magic number. Do you know what that's in reference
350.
To?
350. No, parts per million?
Yes,
oh,
specifically of?
Carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide emissions in the atmosphere that at least some scientists say is a safe, the safe end still, but of the upper limit of the safe limit.
See, I almost said ozone, but that's the layer that's actually damaged by what's going on with this stuff, I guess. So, a plastic six-pack holder takes 450 years to disintegrate. Did you know that?
No.
That takes longer to disintegrate than a hard plastic container or a disposable diaper. Both of those take their own sweet time,
wow,
too, but that's amazing.
Did you say 450 years?
450 years. So that's around for somebody to dig up out of our fire circles back in the, you know, the fire pits in the backyard.
Sure.
Well,
Let's see here. Okay, here's one I thought was kind of interesting. If you took all of the water on Earth and collected it into a single drop, it would be how far across?
All the water?
Yeah.
Every bit of water?
You might be surprised that it's a smaller number than you might think. But
oh, okay.
I'm going to give you a couple choices. 500 miles, 860 miles across, or 1,250.
All the water. I'm going to go with 500 miles because you kind of gave me a hint.
860.
Oh, see, and I should have gone in the middle.
For reference sake, that's about the same distance. Fargo to Indianapolis is 825 miles, and Bismarck to Salt Lake City is 920. So still takes up a pretty good chunk of our nation here.
Okay. Well, it was some great trivia. And now we'll move on to Chuck Lura, whose natural North Dakota essay today is not what I said in the open, is Pass Flower.
The calendar says spring, but I'm not convinced yet. Many among us will declare spring has arrived when we see flocks of geese flying overhead. But for the botanically inclined, spring is not official until the pasque flower is in bloom. They're among the earliest wildflowers to bloom in the prairies during spring. Their pale blue to mauve flowers, about an inch and a half in diameter with a dense cluster of yellow anther, stand in stark contrast to the brown vegetation below. Pasque flowers are well dressed for the spring cold. The stem and leaves support a rather dense covering of long, soft white hairs, which serve to insulate the plant and also provide a sort of greenhouse effect in the microclimate surrounding it. They defy the cold. Perhaps it's the plant's defiance of winter. Maybe it's the simple beauty of the plant. But for whatever the reason, this spring beauty has been chosen to be the provincial flower of Manitoba and the state flower of South Dakota. Although pasque flower is sometimes known as wild crocus, it's not a crocus. True crocuses are members of the iris family, which includes the garden crocus as well as the crocus species from which saffron is made. Pasque flower is a member of the buttercup family, which includes buttercups, anemones, larkspurs, and meadow rue. So don't collect the stigmas from wild crocus and expect to flavor rice like saffron. Nina Farley Wishick, a homesteader in McIntosh County, wrote a poem about the pasque flower. Here's a little excerpt. April has come and spring is here, and the first wildflowers of the year are the dainty blooming crocus deer, rightly called the pasque flower. Its fuzzy, wuzzy stem and stalk staunchly stands where'er I walk. I listen for the whispering talk of the furry little pasque flower. A smiling face lifts to the eye. I see a crocus, the children cry, and up and down they wildly fly to gather up the pasque flower. Still scattering your purple power, born of April shine and shower, leave us rich in prairie dower, the lovely little pasque flower. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center and Dakota College at Botno. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
Neat little story there about the pasque flower from Chuck Lura. Thank you for that, Natural North Dakota. And now we go to another Earth Day feature of Main Street, the news with Danielle.
Thanks, Doug. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The attorney representing a Cooperstown man convicted of the murder of an NDSU researcher says there was not enough evidence to find his client guilty. Daniel Wacht was sentenced to life without parole for the death of Kurt Johnson. Johnson's severed head was found in Wacht's basement, but the rest of the body has not been found. Attorney Stephen Mottinger told the North Dakota Supreme Court there are too many unanswered questions about what happened after Johnson and Wacht left a Cooperstown bar on New Year's Eve in 2010. Justice Dale Sandstrom questioned Mottinger.
You're saying there's not sufficient evidence when the deceased was last seen in your client's vehicle and the deceased's head was found in your client's basement?
Does not necessarily mean that Mr. Wacht was the individual that committed the murder. We've got that shell casing with unidentified male DNA on it and Mr. Johnson's DNA.
And I'm really wondering, so what?
And in one of Mr. Walk's boots, there's unidentified male DNA inside one of his boots. So at least allows us to draw the inference that someone else was there.
Mottinger also says the first and second search warrants contained erroneous information and should be thrown out. Assistant Griggs County State's Attorney Marina Spahr told the court there is plenty of evidence to convict Wacht. The high court has taken the case under advisement. The Senate has approved a compromise pay plan for state workers for the next 2 years. It comes after a series of conference committee meetings, and it means a number of budget bills that have the single issue of the pay plan as a sticking point will start moving through the process. The plan is a 4-3 plan with money set aside for market pay issues. It also increases the retirement contribution in the first year of the biennium, but makes no change for the second year. The Senate had been sticking with the governor's 4-4 plan, while the House had been pushing for a 3-3. Grand Forks Senator Ray Holmberg chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee.
I think at the end of the day, we weren't cheering. There were some things we would have liked to have done differently. But, Mr. President, as you know, the perfection is the purview of God. We just do the best we can. And that's what I think you have before us here today, is about the best we could do.
The pay plan language is contained in the Office of Management and Budget spending bill. That bill is traditionally the last bill the legislature passes to end the session. And a Fargo state senator says he's hoping to get the full Senate to reject a conference committee report on a bill to increase speeding fines. Democrat George Sinner was on the conference committee. He says he had hoped conference would look seriously at higher fines for roads posted at a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit.
The safest roads that we have in our whole system are the interstate highways, and people drive faster there. And why? Because we have passing lanes. We've got these ripples on all those highways now, and we're starting to put these ripples in the median on a lot of our two-lane state highways. But none of the county roads are doing that, and that's where we're mostly having our problems are on the two-lane roads. All the evidence shows it.
Sinner also is hoping that the conference committee will reconsider allowing a city or county with a home rule charter to set its own speeding fines. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and we're talking now with Barton Sutter, whose new book of poems, The Reindeer Camps, is in my hand, and he's in the studio with me. Barton, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Excited to be in North Dakota. Haven't been here for some time, and so far the trip's going great.
And what brings you to North Dakota?
I've got a gig in the Heart River Writers Circle out at Dickinson State. And it's a two-day mini festival, I guess. So I have a couple of readings and visit a class. And they're going to do a staged reading of one of my verse plays. So it's an exciting time.
So you write verse plays as well?
I make things just as hard for myself as possible.
What's the name of the verse play?
Pine Creek Parish.
And is it, I think we mentioned before we went on the air, that that sounds a bit reminiscent of Spoon River Anthology, that kind of small town ethos, telling the personal stories of who's in the cemetery in that particular
it's
case?
It's very much in that vein. I spent the first six years of my life up on the Canadian border, north of Roseau, Minnesota, which is pretty hard to do to get north of Roseau and still be in the United States, but I am. And I know that people in North Dakota know Roseau because Roseau has sent many a hockey player to the University of North Dakota. Anyhow, this was in a little village really outside of Roseau, and got to know lots of quirky characters in that time. And so much of that play is based on those sorts of folks that I learned.
Well, your work seems to rely on your sense of place, where you're from, the kinds of people you've met, your heritage. Give us a little bit of your biography.
Well, my dad grew up in Great Lakes, in Detroit Lakes, and he went to Concordia, Moorhead. So I like to think of myself as an honorary North Dakotan. We'll see what they say out in Dickinson. But he became a minister, and so that's my background. I'm one of the dreaded preacher's kids, and I used to tell people that's like falling in love or getting polio. You never really get over it. And I lived in these tiny towns in Minnesota and Iowa. Bemidji State 2 years, and then I went to Southwest Minnesota State. And and on to Syracuse. I spent 10 years in the printing trade and then did part-time teaching and freelance writing until I finished up full-time teaching at the University of Wisconsin-Superior 2 years ago, and yes, I was born for retirement.
Very good. Well, we share something. I'm from Detroit Lakes originally, too, and my father actually was the co-owner of a small newspaper there, the Becker County Record, which still publishes, and it, of course, had a print shop attached to it.
So. Oh, there, you see? This was all fated.
Okay. Now, what brought you to poetry? Why that form of literature?
That's a good question I ask myself often because my folks read to me a lot when I was a kid. The only technology in far northern Minnesota was the radio at that time. So there was lots of reading, and I had a grandmother who was lived to be 97, was a fabulous gossip and storyteller. So maybe it was inevitable that I'd become a writer of some kind, but there wasn't much emphasis on poetry in those early years. My mom got sick and died when she was, in young middle age, and I started writing poems within the year after she died. So I expect it began as kind of therapy, and I discovered the Beatniks shortly thereafter, and it seemed like with poetry there was a different way of talking than most Midwesterners do most of the time. There was a kind of intensity that maybe spoke for what people felt as opposed to what they were saying, or some tension between those two things. And I got an assignment from the worst English teacher I ever had in high school to write a poem over the weekend. I did two, and I've never really stopped since.
Wow. Well, so that English teacher did some very good work in a way.
Yeah, right. You just never know where it's going to come from.
Well, let's talk about the new book, The Reindeer Camps. Where does the title come from?
The title comes from the longest poem in the, which is really a cycle of poems. And it's, I suppose, a bit odd, but what happened was that I fell in love with a book. And then with animals and people. That is, somebody had given me a gift card at Christmas, and I was in a bookstore with that card burning a hole in my pocket. And this book just kind of jumped off the shelf into my hand. I'm sure everybody's had that experience at one time or another. But it was called The Reindeer People. It was by an anthropologist named Pierce Vitebsky, who had spent 20 years with Siberian reindeer herders. And I said, well, it's clear this book is for me. Why, one wonders, but I've always been drawn to northern subjects. And I went into it was really well written, not academic at all. And I went into a kind of literary swoon with that, reading slowly because I didn't want it to end. And about a week after I was done with the book, I heard a voice in my head. Yeah, that happens to poets. And schizophrenics, both. And the words were, in reindeer camps, we feed the fire first. Vodka, tea, bits of meat. We feed the fire spirit first. It eats before we eat. Otherwise, we'll have bad dreams. We'll have bad dreams, or worse. In reindeer camps, we feed the fire first. And I thought, oh, no. I feel there's something coming on here. And I am not now, nor was I ever, a Siberian reindeer herder. So there's a bit of a problem there. I'm writing in the first person as if I were, you know, an indigenous person, which is also always dicey. But I said, the impulse is so strong here, I'm going to go ahead and write this, and then I will check with people who will know whether this is exploitative or wrong. And I got the thumbs up from everybody, and so I eventually put it in print.
So you're kind of channeling a Finn?
Yeah, well, I Sami, Siberians. I am myself all Swedish in background, so I think there's a, maybe blood memory working here. It feels real natural. Yeah.
Well, I also noticed that you rely a fair amount on personalities that you'd see, for example, in the North Woods of Minnesota or Michigan. You talk about Aho's, a Finnish name. I know we had a scholarship at the university I went to that was named after a fellow by the name of Ino Aho from the northern peninsula of Michigan, up in Iron Range country there.
Yeah, yeah. I have great affection for the Finns, and I know you've got some here in North Dakota. I looked it up, mostly in the eastern counties. And they are my favorite, really, of all the Scandinavian ethnic groups. And, you know, maybe I should switch to Finnish. They get teased a lot in Minnesota because they were the last of all the Scandinavian groups to come in. And it turns out because of that, there wasn't much land left except for swamps and bog. And they're real stubborn. They stuck to it. They made it go. And they're real good with cooperatives and that kind of thing. But they still get teased a lot. Well, one of my friends is a fellow named Jim Johnson, who's a semi-professional Finlander. And I thought I should write him a poem, both as a tease and a tribute. Should I read that?
Oh, please do.
And I imagined it in the voice of one of the Swedes or Norwegians that I grew up around there on the Canadian border. So I can't read it without a Scandinavian lilt. So here's an old Swede speaking who thinks the Finns are so different, you know, so odd, so exotic. Those Finnish folk live out to Toivola, skinny woods and bog. Sorry sort of country, overlooked by most, pioneered by people awful fond of failure. They branch out to Twig, you know, down as far as Esko, Askov, Bruno, over there to Togo, Effie, Emily, Ten Strike, Shooks. Wherever you would never, there you'll find the Finn. They believe in sauna, nudity, and coffee. Their wallpaper is birch bark. Their lazy boy's a stump. The women are good lookers. The men folk, not so much. They specialize in blueberries, hay fields and alders, rocks and pickled pike. They don't go in for paint much, like a weathered look. Tar paper buildings, wood piled high. Go and introduce yourself. Coffee's always hot. Their names are Nordic music, silly and profound, descended from the Polska. Calling to the cows, whittled willow whistles, woodwinds, drums, names like Ada Aho, Pavu Havumaki, Sulo Sari, Yoki Kovaroya. Where'd they learn such laughter? Poverty and wolves, love cries of women, crooning of the loons, watching how the crops grow. Here comes the hail. Water makes a big splash, then it runs away. Wind whacks the window, sifts through snow.
Oh, a little humor in there, too.
Oh, yeah, try for a little bit.
And I think it's kind of intriguing that the Finns invent a holiday called St. Erho Day.
Yeah,
and I think they did it in Minnesota, if
yeah,
I don't remember.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. There are a lot of them there.
So what's it like writing poems the way you write it? Because oftentimes we think the poems, you know, these days modern poems don't rhyme anymore. Well, you put a little rhyme in. You make you have a little meter there.
Yes, I do. My brother, when I was finished with this, I didn't know what I was doing for sure, and that's part of the key to writing a good poem, is not knowing entirely what you're doing. And my brother said, who's a musician, said, when you're done with that, do you realize that's a schottische? So who knows what kinds of things, you know, run through your intuition and so on. But, yeah, I've always believed strongly in the connection between poetry and music. It's an ancient one. And I do a fair amount of performing with my brother as the Sutter Brothers.
Okay.
Fairly clever. And we've got a program that integrates poetry and music, and I'm sure that listening to the old folk songs he does has had an enormous influence on my writing. So I do about half of it in meter and rhyme and the rest in free verse.
And when somebody picks up Reindeer Games and reads one of your pieces of work, is there a narrative they should fully understand, or is it something they can put together for themselves? I mean, are you telling a specific story, or are they sort of developing their own out of it?
There's quite a variety of work in this book. So there's everything from political poems to light verse to, say, the reindeer camps. So each poem is meant to stand on its own, but they're all also fairly carefully arranged. It's when you go to put the book together, it's a bit like writing one big poem because you try to get one poem to play off another. But, you know, in general, what holds it together, I'd say, is Northern sensibility, and I feel this ought to be a big hit because I'm in North Dakota.
Well, here you go, Jukebox Tunes from the Dirty Shame Saloon. When I looked at this one, I thought, have I seen some of these titles? Because it sounded like a lot I'd seen.
Yeah, well, I say that the origin for this was actually, it was set up for me by Bill Clefcorn, who recently died. He was a poet in Nebraska. And he'd played this game before, but I like to say that I stumbled into a tavern back in the woods when I was out fishing in northern Minnesota, and I had a great cheeseburger, and all I needed to make my day complete was to play a couple of tunes on the jukebox, and I was expecting country western, and what I found was country northern. So here it is, Jukebox Tunes from the Dirty Shame Saloon. Just a list of titles. Her perfume smelled like bug dope, and he can't forget. Evergreen Blues. Oh, for nice. Meet me in the fish house, and we'll somehow find the room. Voices sure sound louder over water. The peat bog king of Coochiching. You might wear moose hide mucklucks, but you've got an ugly truck. Blueberry Boogie. The oil can rag. Oof de mega mama, there's a teardrop in my eye. Where have all the crew cuts gone? You must be a mosquito babe, because you sure love to whine. The trout creel reel. Fooey on you. Somewhere north of nowhere, everything went south. Shotgun shottish. Lake Superior's wide and blue, and so, my love, are you. The trouble with linoleum. When I think back on lutefisk and left so warm and dry, my man's an iron miner, but he's not made of steel. Snowshoe shuffle with a boy toy, the cedar swamp stomp. When the smelt buckets are loaded, I'm coming home to you.
Those are fun. That's a lot of fun, actually. So what instructs you about the order of the poems that you put in the book? And because some of them you've written before, and some of them have appeared in other, you know, works, and yet you put them in this particular order.
Well, some of them go way back, it's true, and then you tend to have a burst of things, I do at least, when once I see how the poems are relating to each other. It's very interesting. They just kind of naturally group themselves over time, and if something's not fitting, then you pull it out and save it for another collection. But there's a section here based on childhood poems out of the village there up in northern Minnesota. Then there's a section on of poems that seem to be about landscape, animals, culture of the north. There's a group of political poems. There's a group of light verse, which was new for me, of which this Jukebox Tunes is obviously a part. Section on kind of literary life, books and reading, section of love poems, and then the extended poem, cool. The reindeer camp. So they it's almost like watching iron filings kind of get attracted to a particular area or something. Over time, they tend to group themselves, and I just trust that relationship.
Well, it begins actually very seriously with one called Alakazam.
Alakazam. Right.
And then there was one I also read with you in Spain that was extremely wistful. I mean,
there's
brought a tear to my eye.
Oh, so. Good. Good. Tears and laughter. That's what I'm after.
And you rhyme even when you're doing that. Oh, thank you very much. It's Barton Sutter, his new book, The Reindeer Camps. He's in Dickinson again this week for
Heart River Writer Series, 2 days, Tuesday and Wednesday.
And that event funded in part by the North Dakota Humanities Council. So thank you very much to the Humanities Council, and thank you, Barton Sutter, for joining us today. More Main Street in a moment. ¶¶
have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. Just email mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or send us a message via the Main Street at Prairie Public Facebook page. And you can still call. The Main Street toll-free studio line is 888-755-6377.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public, which is what makes introducing Bruce Berg's commentary this week so pleasant. It's titled Main Street.
There was a time, not long ago to me, but a long, long time ago to my kids' generation, when the words Main Street conjured up rows of mom-and-pop stores ranging in my hometown and yours, from hardware to shoe shops, from grocery stores to photography studios, from women's clothing to jewelry stores, barbershops and drugstores and flower shops and dry cleaners and dime stores and meat markets, furniture stores, small cafes and bars. These stores still exist, obviously, but in a different form. Our past Main Streets took on a new look when Mom and Pop retired or just got tired competing with the volume dealers and the mega businesses that soon began to take up a huge space at the end of Main Street or up the hill a piece. The shoppers who frequented Main Street discovered that loyalty to their billfolds took precedence over loyalty to the shops and stores of their Main Street past. The general store may have been a part of many a small community, but the new general stores weren't owned by Mom and Pop, and they offered a range of goods that would climax each year in the Black Friday, Get Out of My Way, Stop-a-thons. The charm of an old Main Street couldn't hold a candle to the bright lights of the malls of America. Main Street USA isn't so charming these days, although there are exceptions, and many a community has tried vigorously and financially to reenact those old days of small-town shopping. I commend the efforts that have been made to add a touch of nostalgic flavor to the architecture, the charm, and the style of the best of yesteryear. But, sorry, dollar stores and loan shops and tacky this and tacky that have taken over the business on so many a Main Street, and as Walter Cronkite used to say, that's the way it is. But I can't help remembering a day on Main Street when life was just a little less hurried, not quite so noisy, and time for a little more conversation with Mom and Pop other than, have a nice day. This is Bruce Berg, Jamestown.
And a reminder to all of our Main Street listeners that we're looking for photographs of your Main Street. So send it to us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. If you want to just send it to an email, just attach that to mainstreet@prairiepublic.org. Or you can find us on Facebook and post it on our wall there. We are Main Street at Prairie Public on Facebook as well. Looking forward to your photographs of your Main Street. Dakota Datebook is next.
Hey, this is Peter Sagal, and I was wondering, if you're not doing anything on May 2nd, would you like to go to the movies and see our show? Because we'll be simulcasting Wait Wait Live from New York City to theaters all over the country. And I thought it'd be, fun if you could come. Maybe we'll get a soda after, if that's okay. That's Wait Wait Live in theaters on May 2nd.
That's coming up May 2nd at the Grand Theater in Bismarck and Century 10 in Fargo at 7 p.m. More information at prairiepublic.org/radio.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Dakota Datebook is provided by Attorney Daniel Buchanan of Buchanan Law Office in Jamestown, specializing in elder law and estate planning. Information on these and other legal matters is available at 252-6604.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 22nd. Scores of North Dakota residents along the Red River fought to save homes, farms, and businesses during the flood of April 1979. The Army Corps of Engineers reported that these flood-fighting efforts had prevented nearly $80 million in damage, saving countless homes. Most of the fight that year took the form of good old-fashioned sandbagging, since the flood was largely unexpected and took the valley by surprise. While heavy snowfall during the winter months is usually the main culprit, the 1979 flood was largely caused by heavy spring rains. Additionally, a rapid warming melted the snowpack at a rate much quicker than normal. Usually, most of the precautionary measures, such as the building of earthen dikes using heavy equipment, would have taken place earlier. But that year, short notice necessitated the use of ad hoc sandbagging and back-breaking human labor. Shipments of the bags used were airlifted into the Grand Forks Air Force Base by the Air Force and Air National Guard planes. Clay and sand were transported into the city by enormous dump trucks, and volunteers filled bags by night and day, building enormous dikes around the city. Spring rains continued to pour down nearly nonstop during the flood, making conditions for volunteers even worse than usual and completely saturating the water table. Grand Forks flood officials were forced to move their headquarters from the city's police station when the basement walls of the building began to crack and leak from the rising water table. On April 23rd, the river's discharge at Grand Forks reached 82,000 cubic feet per second, a rate that was exceeded at the time only by the flood of 1897. All along its length, tributaries of the river established new discharge records that spring. On this date in 1979, the Army Corps reported that an estimated 3.7 million sandbags had been used to fight the river. Ultimately, the river flooded more than 1 million acres of farmland and caused over $100 million in damage. However, without the efforts of flood volunteers that year, the cost would have been nearly twice that amount. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jamie Jobe. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Just enough time left in Main Street to tell you what's coming up tomorrow. Did you know, for example, that North Dakota was home to an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II? We'll get some of that history from Dennis Newman, Public Information Director at the United Tribes Technical College, the grounds of which were used as part of the government's alien enemy control program during World War II. We'll also hear from a professor who teaches in Japan, teaches intercultural studies, from the perspective of the Japanese. And Ashley's got something real tasty.
I have got an interview with Square One Kitchens, and this is a startup that helps startups start up. Does that make sense? This is a facility that's really kind of a sign of the times. There's so much room for expansion in this state, and it's also a sign of the friendly business culture in this area. There's actually people who are technically competitors working together. So we're going to dive deep into Square One Kitchens and let you know what that's all about.
I look forward to that. Look forward to having you with us tomorrow. In the meantime, stay warm and have a great evening.